Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. All right, Brent. Well, we're now at part three of this interview. We've covered your history. We've covered a bit about Joseph Smith. And then we've covered quite a bit about, kind of maybe a secular theory for the Book of Mormon and Grant Palmer's view and what it is about the Book of Mormon at a high level that you find, you know, valuable or miraculous or special that secular views just can't quite explain. And we haven't dug much into that, but we've, you know, touched on it a little bit. Now, given that we're going to it's kind of funny. Terrell Givens used this word, go down the rabbit hole. Have you heard that phrase before?
Right.
So what we're going to do now, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way. I'm lovingly invoking Terrell Givens when I say that. We're going to go down the rabbit hole a bit, and we're going to talk about if you are to believe that there's a God, and if you are to believe that God works, as Richard Bushman said, if you want to believe in a world where God works, you know, through prophets in this world, and that God chose to work with Joseph Smith to bring about the Book of Mormon through gold plates, then you have to ask some other questions, because, you know, we talk about the Book of Mormon being viewed as, you know, the most correct book on the face of the earth. I think that's a quote that's been used about it. And so we expect it. We sort of maybe are raised to expect it to have never been changed, to have never had any flaws, to represent the fullness of the gospel, and to sort of stand on its own in many ways, where Joseph would have just been someone who facilitated it, but in no way would his own personal opinions or vocabulary or anything have influenced it in any way. And all that sort of presumes or presupposes a certain view on what it means to translate. Is that right?
Yes.
And so in your book, The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon, again, Greg Kofford Books, Greg, KOFFORD.com. In this book, you tackle head on what it does and doesn't mean to translate. Now, I'm going to start by giving you what I understood the process to be with the Book of Mormon. There's a couple things. First of all, we have this perception that Joseph obtained this thing called a Urim and Thummim, okay? And what I think of when I think of Urim and Thummim is some Old Testament-like breastplate with some type of goggles or glasses where Joseph's sitting in front of the plates. He's got the glasses on. He's got the breastplate. And so that's part one. And then part two is that somehow he's looking at these characters in Reformed Egyptian. And I don't know where I get this, but I think it's from someone's quote. He's actually watching the English appear before his eyes or his mind's eye or spiritual eyes. And then he's simply dictating whatever these, you know, the English that emerges from this process to the scribe who's in the room. And, you know, he's separated by a curtain. And the scribe is simply writing down the English that Joseph is, saying or speaking. And so it's a very literal thing, using these sort of ancient relics that he got when he grabbed the plates out of the ground. Now, based on the historical record, and we've talked about this before, but tell us how this, just based on historical accounts, might not be factually accurate in terms of the mechanics of the translation. Then we'll talk about the theories on the spiritual nature of the translation. But let's talk about the mechanics.
Yeah.
How did that get it wrong?
Well, let me start with one other sort of background piece, because I kind of had to do this in the text of the book. It seems to put the cart before the horse to try to talk about whether or not, you know, what kind of translation the Book of Mormon is, if we haven't settled the fact that it is a translation. So one of the things you have to posit in the book in order to move on is that it is a translation. So all these questions about historicity and everything are, in volume two, I guess. At one point in time, I had hoped to put it all together, and it just wasn't going to work. So you begin with that, you know, saying that this is a translation. So the next thing is mechanically what happened. And the best information that we have is that Joseph, who was this village seer and who understood what a seer stone was, got hold of the interpreters in the Book of Mormon, which were delivered with the plates, and he understood them as though they were seer stones and thought they were wonderful, and apparently used them to translate the 116 pages that were lost. It appears that they were returned with the plates, and that Joseph, after that point in time, no longer had those interpreters that had been delivered with the plates. And it appears that all of the text of the Book of Mormon that we have was translated with a seer stone. And the way you use a seer stone is to put it in the crown of a hat and to put your head in the hat to exclude all light. And that process mechanically is how you use them, no matter how you're going to use them and what you're going to use them for. And that somehow that's how you're getting the translation. And of course, what that pretty much precludes is Joseph Smith reading any manuscript. It pretty much precludes him reading, putting his finger on the plates, as Thomas Coe had indicated from an 1836 story that the saints had told. It really appears that the plates themselves weren't being consulted at the time. So mechanically, it certainly doesn't look like any translation that we know about. Again, no dictionaries around, no scholars sitting in dusty rooms trying to, you know, figure out the meaning of certain characters and in verb tenses. It was a process that came through inspiration. And again, you go back to the fact that none of that works without positing the presence of God in the process.
Right. Okay. Okay. That I hear that. Let me just go back and, well, let me just ask you then to say what we do know about the mechanics of how he translated it. The versions that we have now.
Do you mean the way people tend to think of it?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, you get all kinds of ways that people will.
I'm talking about the hat and the stone. We have an account of people that were in the room with him describing what physical artifacts were used and how. And I just want to make sure that that version gets told.
Yeah, Joseph appears to sit with his seer stone in the crown of the hat and puts his head in the hat and dictates the text. What people who saw it, you mentioned the curtain. It appears that the curtain that had been hung was actually hung at the door to keep people from bothering Joseph and his scribe, rather than between Joseph and the scribe. But Joseph is dictating, and he is dictating, according to Royal Skousen's examination of the original manuscript, about 20-some-odd words at a time, and then the scribe would write them down, and Joseph would continue. And the descriptions of the process were Joseph would give the sentence these 20 or so words. They'd say they were written, and then they'd go on to other ones. Every once in a while, typically at the beginning, the first time you'd come up with an unusual name, Joseph would spell it out. And the witnesses to the process saw that, or you could hear that there were times when Joseph was spelling words. So that process is what was described later on. And then in some cases, the people who were describing it were trying to imagine what Joseph might have seen with his head in the hat. And that's where we get, you know, the words would appear on parchment. And you know, we don't know for certain where that came from, whether someone decided that that's what happened or Joseph had mentioned that's what happened. That part we don't know.
Okay. And again, we're not going to dig too much more into this, but you can imagine how difficult it is for people to hear this count. On the one hand, it's true that Elder Russell M. Nelson, I guess, there's an article in the Ensign from 10 or 20 or 30 years ago that sort of lets, you know, that sort of conveys this account that the plates probably weren't in the room, or at least there's no evidence that the plates were in the room, that this Urim and Thummim that we thought was being used really wasn't used, but instead it was a stone in a hat with Joseph's face in the hat. And then, as I understand it, it's one of the same stones that Joseph would have used in his previous treasure digging expeditions. Is that possible? Is that likely?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then I would only qualify it to say that by limiting it to treasure digging, you've artificially limited horse, you know, what it was really used for.
Horse finding.
It was the process of trying to find things that were lost.
Okay. Now I'm not trying to stack the deck. This is what people get hung up on. And so, you know, this is something I was never taught in seminary. It's something I was never taught at BYU. It's something I've never heard mentioned over the pulpit or a general conference. And I would say 95% of the church is still unaware of this. And whenever the church depicts the translation, I've never once seen the church depict a picture with Joseph with his head in a hat.
Well, let's just make sure that we understand that it's artists that are depicting it, not the church.
Well, the church shows the artist's renderings.
The church shows the artist's rendering.
And they published the church's the artist's renderings.
Well, and they published Arnold Freeberg, and believe me, there are very few men that look like those guys.
No, I know, but we know that the translation happened in a way different than the way the church is choosing to depict it. And the church at any time could commission an artist to do a more accurate depiction in the way that's historically accurate, and they choose not to. So,
well, frankly, that's one of the questions that I had in the first third of the book is, you know, why do we tell the stories? One of the things that I point out in the first chapter is, you know, here's what the story is and the best information we have for how it occurred. But very, very soon, you know, within 3 years, or excuse me, 6 years of the church being published, that wasn't the story the Mormons were telling. You know, Presbyterian minister Thomas Coe gives us the quotation that talks about Joseph translating by looking through the spectacles with his, you know, as he traces the characters on the plates with his finger. It's a question of why did that story become the one that got circulated, and why did it change so rapidly? And I think that's, you know, one of the interesting questions, and it has to do with the nature of history and the nature, again, of how folk histories are created and how communities pass stories around. And in many ways, it's because it was more understandable to them than, you know, when they were trying to figure out how Joseph Smith would have done it. That story made more sense to them, and so that's the one they told. I suspect that that's the reason why it continues to be told, is it just makes more sense to people. And, you know, the historical accuracy, frankly, wasn't anything that people were terribly concerned with until recently.
Right. And this is an instance where I'm not going to... Are you okay? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Bless you. It's going to sound like I'm trying to put you at odds with the church, but I'm really not. But someone would say, dang, don't you think it would be responsible of the church to clarify this now and to just start teaching the story accurately? And do you ever feel frustration that they haven't done it? Because apologists will all acknowledge that it's the feeling of being betrayed or deceived that always stings more than the actual evidence, because it's all down the rabbit hole, whether he's using, you know, breastplates and goggles or a seer stone, it's all supernatural. So are you, you know, how do you feel about the fact that we're still not depicting this accurately?
I guess I'm too much of a historian to worry about that. My questions are always, how did we get to this point? I'm always surprised that people feel betrayed because somebody else hasn't taught them something where there's information that they could easily go learn something about. And perhaps one of the reasons why I wrote the book was so that there was another source out there that people could go to learn about this kind of thing and to do it with some understanding of what the historical process is. But you know, things don't happen in vacuums. They happen historically. They happen because of the people who were there. We tell the stories that we tell for lots of different reasons. Frankly, I'm really surprised at this entire idea of someone assuming that the church was betraying them. Because again, it seems to say that somebody else is responsible for telling me things, you know, that are going to shock me. If you look at a worldwide church, you know, that's really pretty irrelevant. The information about what the Book of Mormon is and what it teaches is really significant to people's eternal salvation. The way it was translated, that's a historical question.
I guess I just feel like, given the fact that we do seminary and institute and Sunday school for so many years, it just feels like the responsible thing to do. If we know now, which we do, that this is a problem for lots of people, it just feels to me like the responsible thing to do to set the record straight. Given that the church is going to be producing this curriculum, they're going to be talking about the translation, and they're going to be showing pictures of it. It just it, I can understand your point that we've gotten where we are, however we've gotten here. I can even understand that let's not blame people or you know, be negative about it. But don't you think setting the record straight is the responsible thing to do given where we are now?
Well, let me tell you about a conversation I had with my wife when she was teaching early morning seminary. We started talking about the nature of things that you teach. And then we started talking about what those kids needed and what was important in their lives. And the kinds of things that she would perceive that they needed to learn had to do with how are they going to live their lives? How are they going to take principles of the gospel and you know, and do something with them? You know, at that level, there were very, very few of the students in her class that were at the point where you said, you know, let's delve into history and get history right. They didn't know much history to know that they had any of it wrong. Sunday school classes, I've taught them. You have the same kind of thing. You know, what is it that you're trying to teach in a Sunday school class? It's you know, the things that they are interested in teaching. It's not that you're misrepresenting any of it. You're skipping it entirely because you're on to something else in the short amount of time that you have that is deemed to be more important. Now, if we don't start teaching it when we get into institute, into college level classes, then I'm going to be terribly disappointed. But Sunday school, you know, there's just a different purpose for them. Something else is happening there.
And seminary too?
Seminary too. You know, most of the experience I've seen with them is that most of them are young enough and inexperienced enough in the gospel that what they're still learning how to do is to, you know, apply those things to their lives. What does it really mean? I doubt very many of them are terribly interested in any kind of history, let alone you know, specifics of LDS history.
So what I hear you saying is maybe not appropriate for Sunday school or seminary. By the time we get to BYU religious education and institute, you think that it would be responsible for this to be covered?
That's where I would see it, and I think it is going to take perhaps some changes in the philosophy of some of the people who teach there. I suspect that many of them would use that same argument to say that the college kids still need it, but I would certainly like to see much more of the history taught more accurately at the institute and college level.
And you do see that this is tripping people up, right? I mean, I'm
of course, yeah,
lots of people, right?
Oh, I mean, it's you don't read things on the internet without noticing that there are people who get disturbed about that. I would certainly wish that people who come up with that idea of betrayal might, talk to some other people before they allow that sentiment to influence the way they feel about the church.
Right. And that's why I wanted to bring you on, to provide role models for belief that didn't only lead to disaffection, you know? So that's why I'm really, really glad. I can imagine that the curriculum committee is just thinking, well, if we depicted this new way, the biggest problem is it's different from the old way. And then it gets people saying, well, that's weird. It's even weirder. And it means that I should start questioning what's been taught in the past. Do you imagine that might be the conversations that happen at the curriculum level about introducing this stuff, that they don't know how to do it without introducing more problems and questions?
I suppose it's possible that there would be that kind of a question. I have limited experience with the curriculum committee, but I know that one of the real problems they have is that they can only begin work on a new manual for either seminary, institute, or even Sunday school periodically. That thing's going to be around for several years. So even if they're in the process of making some changes right now, we're not going to see them for a few years.
Right.
So, they may have decided to make certain changes a couple of years ago, and, just in the nature of how things work, it'll come out more slowly.
Right.
Unfortunately, the nature of sort of any kind of religious organization is that things tend to be pretty conservative and change relatively slowly. It's just, that's kind of the nature of what we expect from a church.
But you do imagine that the day that they do roll all that out, it will cause some people to start asking more questions, right? It could be a trigger for further questioning and potential doubt, right?
If certainly anytime something like that is done, if it's done correctly, it should be able to prevent doubt rather than introduce it. It's all in the presentation. I think the biggest problem that we have in the church is that it's a lay church, and that when we teach seminary and institute and Sunday school, the person who's teaching us next week is sitting in the class the week before and doesn't know any more about it than we do. Unless it's CES, and that's again a different kind of process, and I guess you see that a lot in Utah, but I've lived most of my life outside, away from the mothership.
Right. And do you like this idea of inoculation, that if we can just teach the history accurately in the early years, we'll likely have less disillusionment later? Do you believe that?
I certainly believe that education is always good. So, yes, I would like to see it. I guess part of my problem is I would love to start teaching the high school students perhaps a little bit more sophisticated course than the kinds of things they get. And that's the reason I had the conversation with my wife. Some of the things I would love to start teaching to them, she's saying, they're just not ready for it. And that's, it's a legitimate concern as to what is your goal in teaching the various ages. Certainly, I'd like to see better instruction in the church all the way around, including Sunday school. I'm not sure I've got the right answer on how to do that.
Yeah, and I'll just confirm. I taught seminary for a couple of years in Seattle, and I was all eager to get into these issues, and the youth just, that's not where they were. They were like, help me, help me survive high school.
Yeah, really, really.
They did not want to talk about historical details at all.
No, and I think it's an important reality to be able to understand that effective teaching understands the people that we're teaching and teaches what they need rather than what we need to think they need.
Yeah, it's true. It was hard for me, but it was totally true. I realized how selfish I was being, and potentially destructive, to be bringing all my concerns into that classroom when it's not where the kids were. It's not what they wanted. It's not what they needed. And it usually didn't help, you know? So
Yeah,
I can confirm that. Okay. So now let's talk about I've set up this expectation or what I've been taught or this certain vision of the translation. And it's a very literal one. And I think there's even some historical backing. You talked about Royal Skousen of this sort of dictation model. But your book talks about several theories of the translation process. And these are theories that might help prevent us from a lot of the pitfalls that were explored during the Michael Coe interview and maybe even in the Grant Palmer interview. And so talk to us about, and I know you've already started touching on it, but do it again and maybe in more depth. Talk about other theories or views of translation that aren't as literal, that are still credible, and that might be helpful in people's understanding of the Book of Mormon and in preventing concerns about the Book of Mormon.
Okay. There are sort of two different parallel issues here. One of them is what kind of translation might the Book of Mormon be? And then the next one is there any evidence that we can discern from the Book of Mormon that would tell us of the options which type it is? So for the first question, you have, again, a range that would say there is a type of translation that is absolutely literal. This is absolutely perfect, and every word is exactly the way it's supposed to be. That's kind of the inerrant philosophy. It's really very evident that the early members of the church believed that, which is hardly surprising because they had kind of an inerrant understanding of the Bible. That was their religious heritage. One of the things that has happened with Skousen's examination of the manuscript is he can show that inerrant concept where, you could not make a mistake does not describe the evidence. So one of the things that we can say is we know that whatever else happens in the translation of the Book of Mormon, it was not, absolutely inerrant and perfect. Even without that, though, there is a type of translation that is what you might call literal, which means that it takes the language and tries to replicate as much as possible the precise vocabulary and the syntax of the original. Then there is another that moves a little bit farther away from that you would call functional. And a functional translation says, okay, I'm going to translate as closely as I can to what's there, but sometimes in order to create understanding, I have to translate slightly differently. For example, if I'm translating a text into another language than English, and somebody has said, boy, that is more fun than a barrel of monkeys, I'm going to have to find some other way to translate that into the other language. And if I'm lucky, there's a parallel idiom.
Right.
But translating that idiom about a barrel of monkeys is going to get somebody terribly confused because I have no idea why a barrel of monkeys is fun. Or as many people have said, if I'm happy as a clam, how happy is a clam? So, certain things don't work. Idioms are really only going to translate well if you do them in a functional translation. And then the last type of translation is one that, sort of conceptual, where you're saying, well, I'm taking the general idea, but I'm retelling it. And the one that most people would be familiar with there might be the Good News Bible that retells the story of the Bible, but in a completely different syntax and vocabulary than what the original Greek or Hebrew might have been. And when I look at the text of the Book of Mormon, trying to find places, where the data will tell me what kind of translation it is, most of the evidence that I see would put it in a functional translation where you're not getting an absolute representation of whatever the vocabulary is. And one of the ways that you can look at that, everybody knows, the horse and the steel and all of those terms. If you believe that the Book of Mormon is a translation, those vocabulary items that we spend all of our time worrying about, can I find a horse, become a very different issue because the horse may or may not have been a horse. And the example I use is the King James Version, where everybody knows that you shouldn't put a candle under a bushel. Very famous. We know that example is there. We quote it all of the time. It never occurs to us that a candle is an anachronism in the King James Version. They had oil lamps. They didn't have candles. Candles came much later.
Doesn't it say light? It doesn't say candle, does it?
I think there's a place where it's – I think it's a candle under the bushel.
So there's references to candle in the King James Version,
yeah,
that would be anachronistic.
That's correct. And okay. And you'll get other kinds of vocabulary like that. Now, when you look at a translation, does that mean that, you know, the King James Version has to be thrown away because it's, you know, it's therefore anachronism and, you know, can't be true? Well, heavens no, it's a translation. That vocabulary item is anachronistic, but it's related to giving light and putting the light under the bushel, that kind of thing. So the meaning is clearly there. They just happen to use, you know, the translators used an anachronism, you know, in the vocabulary.
And I'm just going to confirm this. So even Job, as far back as Job and Psalms, there are references to candle. And mm-hmm. You're saying candles didn't exist back in
right. They came much later.
Old Testament
they would
times.
Yeah. They would have had oil lamps. So yeah, in the New Testament time, the parable of the 10 virgins who need the oil for the lamps, that's accurate. Because it's talking about the lamp and the oil.
Got it.
It's, you know, the candle is an anachronism of vocabulary. And again, now if you go back to the original, it's not going to say candle, it's going to say lamp, but the translator put it in.
Okay.
So once you understand that the Book of Mormon is translation and that there are many reasons why the text, and again, positing that it is a translation, the evidence suggests that it is functionally translated rather than literally.
Okay.
And then you start looking at the vocabulary and what does it mean. But that's the place where you say, you know, there was meaning on the plate, and Joseph's understanding of that was influenced by his understanding of the King James New Testament, and so King James vocabulary for New Testament passages shows up in the Book of Mormon because, you know, that's the way he understood it. Vocabulary from the revivals would show up because that's vocabulary that was quite familiar to him. We do that all the time. The reason that we tend to toss out cliches is because we've heard them so many times that in a context where that becomes applicable, that's just this phrase that comes out because it's easier to come up with something that we've heard before than to come up with something that's completely new.
And just to sort of extend your theory, one of the early critiques that I read of the Book of Mormon was when somebody finds all these names of Book of Mormon characters and of Book of Mormon places around, you know, in Joseph's, in books Joseph would have had, or in maps of towns near Palmyra, you know, according to your theory, you know, there might have been some ancient word for Nephi or Laban or whatever, but how do you make that into English? It very well could have been that Joseph just had to arbitrarily draw on names from maps and literature around him to fill in the blank to put it into English. Would that sort of be an example of extending your theory or this theory?
Or more likely what would happen in the case of names would be that the, you know, particular form, if it was close to something he knew, then it would end up being the name that he was familiar with. So it may not have been exactly like that, but somewhat similar, and it reminded him of that name. Although I have to say, with the specific example you were giving of the Vernal Holly, you know, Joseph Smith saw all these names. A lot of the names that Holly comes up with, you know, did not exist at Joseph Smith's time. So he was still a little bit prescient, but still.
But I mean, you probably could find some of those parallels, right?
Oh yeah,
and as we talked about parallels before,
right? And you know, no matter what you come up with Joseph Smith in rendering these names, he renders them according to his understanding of the sound structure of English. You know, we don't tend to get accurate phonetic representations of, you know, foreign words. Whenever the foreign word is represented, it's represented in, you know, something that would represent vowels and syllable combinations that he would understand.
Yeah, I know people from China who just don't even bother trying to explain how to pronounce their name to people in America. They just adopt an American name because to try and get American people to even pronounce their name correctly after multiple efforts is usually in vain.
Right.
And so they just go with like Lucy or Bill, you know?
Yeah. That kind of thing happens when we tend to only hear the things that we've grown up hearing.
Right.
You know, that's language acquisition theory and, you know, what happens and changes after puberty and all those kinds of things. But definitely in the Book of Mormon, you're going to get Joseph rendering even unfamiliar words in syllabic patterns that are not completely foreign to the way he would understand it.
Okay. So let me ask it. Let me back up and ask you just a higher level question. Did Joseph ever describe the mechanics by which he translated or the, you know, did he ever describe his process?
Joseph basically said one thing. He translated by the gift and power of God. That's it, folks.
That's all he said.
That's all he says.
Okay.
At one point in time, his brother said, you know, we might want to know something more about the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. And, you know, here's Joseph. Joseph, would you explain it? And Joseph says, no, it's not something we need to know now. So the only thing he's really ever on record saying about the process is that he translated through the gift and power of God. And, you know, he never makes that weakness to tell us.
He did use the word translate.
Yeah, he would certainly use the word translate. And I strongly suspect he'd meant the word translate in a very different term than we do. For him, translate wasn't, you know, the way we think of a linguist going through a text. For him, something that was translated, if it was made understandable. So when he translated the Bible, it was not from an original language. It was from English to a version of English that made things more understandable. So his concept of translation was even different than we believe it to be.
Yeah, because this is a real flexible interpretation of the word translate, right? But that's not just created out of necessity. Are you saying that that word, in even non-Mormon context, can have similar meanings to what you're ascribing to it?
In Webster's 1823 dictionary, that is the more common meaning of the word.
And repeat it again, or just give us a sense for it.
Making sense of something. So it wasn't necessarily changing the language. It was, you know, making sense, making it more comprehensible.
So there's meaning in the plates, and then he's trying to say, what's the best way with my vocabulary and with my audience and with the human English language, what's the best way I can convey the meaning that will be maximally or optimally understood by the reading audience?
As a quick thing, yes.
Okay. And you're saying that using the word translate is a reasonable choice of words. There's probably no better choice of words that could have described that process, even though it's different from the word-for-word type of thing that we usually associate with it.
And based on the way he and his contemporaries would have understood the word, it worked perfectly.
Okay.
What's happened is that our concept of that word has shifted since that time, which, you know, it's really not surprising at all. Words change in their, you know, their meaning and their context all the time. But this is one where the word that we use has a set of connotations that are more limited than they were for Joseph Smith.
Got it. Okay. So why? Okay, so again, this notion that I've read some quotes somewhere where the words would appear, he would say the words, and then they would erase. Tell me again where that comes from, and how we synthesize that with this other more functional view of translation.
That's one of the witness accounts, which means that this is what somebody came up with as what they thought Joseph was doing. And all of us, including myself, who come up with some explanation for what Joseph were doing, are using our best guesses, because Joseph Smith said, "I did it through the gift and power of God." And when we say anything else, we're going beyond, you know, what the only person who really knew, you know, could have told us. What I believe happened is that Joseph, in his process of using a seer stone, had a visual memory, so that when he was using the seer stone back in the days as a village seer, and someone would say, you know, "Where is my wallet?" he would see a picture that would say, "This is where the wallet was," and that it was a visual process to him. There is, you know, a sort of scientific explanation for how that process works. All of us have dreams where we see things in our dreams. Some people are more visual than others, and we always have this concept of imagination where we can close our eyes and imagine a picture. Some people are much better at it than others, and some people have a what's called an eidetic memory, which means that they're able to sort of capture pictures and review pictures better than most. In some of the examples, there was one man who had this just phenomenal memory. And people would say, "Well, you know, how do you do this?" And they would describe a large matrix of numbers totally at random. And even years later, he could, you know, repeat series, you know, the diagonal and the horizontal and the vertical. And they asked him how to do it. And he says, "Well, I see a picture of it and I just read it off the board." And I think that's the kind of memory that Joseph had. Where the pieces all get put together is looking at sort of language theory and where language comes from. Steven Pinker examined sort of where we get our words and how do we create sentences. And what he said was, pretty much everybody has had the experience of saying, you know, "Well, that wasn't what I meant to say. What I meant to say was," and if we can say something and be able to understand that the words that came out of our mouth did not reflect what we meant to say, that we have to have some meant to say that is prior to the time that it's encoded into words. And his term for that is mental ease. And he says, you know, this is sort of the pre-language of the brain. We think in mental ease. You know, these processes occur in mental ease. And then we apply vocabulary and language to that meaning as we speak. And I think what happens is the understanding of what was on the plates, and again, this is where you invoke the divine, is given to Joseph Smith, but it's given to him in this pre-language. And what happens is it's Joseph's mind that is taking that meaning, clothing that meaning with vocabulary that he understands, vocabulary that's familiar to him, vocabulary that is certainly in English, that is reflective of the King James Version, because that's the language of Scripture. And then the mental process translates that into a visual process. And to him, it looks like he's reading a text off of the seer stone. I was doing a lot of reading in, you know, what people did with seer stones, and found an interesting example from the late, let's see, I think it was, must have been early 1800s. Andrew Lang, a British anthropologist, decided that he wanted to see what would happen with people who used crystal balls or seer stones or any of these kinds of things. And so he took one. He says, you know, "Here's a crystal ball," and he would hand it to his friends to see if they could see something in it. And, you know, totally without assuming that they could, and it was just the experiment, hardly rigorous, but, you know, he'd pass this thing out. And one of the examples of someone who saw it was this young girl who said what she saw was writing on a paper that was so real she turned the ball over to see the paper on the other side. So there's actually, you know, anecdotal information that someone is able to generate a vision of words on a page. So I think putting all of the pieces together to explain what happens with Joseph Smith, you have a very naturalistic explanation of everything except the content of the Book of Mormon. You can explain why he puts his head in the hat to exclude light. That's so that he and everybody else knows that when he sees something, it is seeing with something beyond sight because you're not seeing with your natural eyes. And that gives him an explanation as to where this is coming from. The information about words on a page that he can see. And the Doctrine and Covenants talks about, you know, this translation of a papyrus from John that's exactly that kind of thing. It's all part of, you know, this process where he can see things. And to him, it looks like he's seeing on the stone, but he's actually, you know, his brain is generating the words and he's reading them off. So I think he really was reading the text, but I think he was reading a text that his brain was translating. And again, the place where you put the divine content in is, you know, here's the content of the Book of Mormon, which means, okay, now we have an explanation for the translation. Now we're left with the text and we have to, again, look at the text and say, well, is it really a translation? And that, of course, is a different and much longer discussion.
Right. Okay. So this approach, which seems reasonable, you know, if you stipulate that God, you know, works with prophets, this seems reasonable. But it really does beg the question, why have plates at all, right? I mean, a tremendous amount of effort would have gone into writing, you know, scratching into these gold leaves, of passing them down from generation to generation, of protecting them. I'm sure Moroni went to a lot of effort to bury them. And then Joseph had to unbury them and wait years to actually obtain them and then hide them and run around, you know, with them to keep people from stealing them. And then when it comes time to actually use them, they're not in the room, according to the accounts we have of the Book of Mormon that we currently have, the version of the Book of Mormon we currently have. So I'm sure you've thought about that question. Why were plates even necessary?
Well, and if you're talking about the translation, you know, perhaps the plates weren't necessary for the translation, but were the plates necessary? Absolutely. How else would Joseph Smith believe that there was something to translate? How would Martin Harris believe that there was something real? How would any of them have been able to, you know, produce them to believe that something was happening, that physical presence of the plates became a touchstone of belief, even for people who did not see them and did not touch them because they had the testimony of the witnesses who did. So that physicality of the plates as plates was very important to what everybody was able to believe about the translation of the text. Now, would the story have been any different if the plates had been used? The translation process might have been exactly the same. Having the plates there wouldn't, in my opinion, have made a significant difference. Would it have made a difference if someone other than Joseph Smith had been the one chosen to do the translation? Brigham Young certainly thought so. He said if somebody else other than Joseph had translated, that our translation would be substantially different. So Brigham's opinion was that there was a lot of Joseph as part of that translation, and I would certainly agree with him. But I certainly believe that the plates were absolutely essential. People needed to have that physical touchstone to be able to know that there was a real connection to real people.
But they weren't necessary for the production of the version of the Book of Mormon we have today, right?
No, and probably couldn't have been. I mean, if we had the plates today and someone put them down in front of me and said, Brant, you translate that. I would look at it and say, okay, where's the dictionary? You know, who's going to teach me the language? I can see characters, but I don't know what they mean. You know, I assume that you have, you know, looked at Chinese and Japanese characters, and they look beautiful. The calligraphy is wonderful. I have no clue what's going on in them. So having that text in front of me, if I were to translate, that wouldn't do me any good.
Right. So they were necessary as part of the story, as part of the building of faith and of the sort of the achieving buy-in among Joseph's peers and associates, less relevant to the actual translation, although apparently he did use them earlier.
He certainly, you know, had perused them and certainly had, you know, copied some characters off. Whether or not that led to any translation, you know, that part of it's not known. And certainly by having the physical plates, you know, Joseph and anyone else who was part of the process of translation would have reason to believe that there was a connection between what Joseph Smith dictated and those physical plates.
Right.
It just wasn't the one where you said, this character means the word the.
Right, right. Well, this obviously reminds me of the theories around the Book of Abraham, because I don't know if you want to tell the story or if you want me to really briefly, but basically, do you want to tell or you want me to?
Oh, you can.
Oh, just that the Joseph purchased apparently some papyri from some mummies that showed up. I think it was in Kirtland, right? And claimed to have translated them into what we now have as the Book of Abraham. But when Egyptologists have reviewed the remnants of the papyri that we still have that survived the fire in the museum, whenever that fire was, they apparently...
Yeah, it's the Great Chicago Fire.
Right. Whatever's written in Egypt on these papyri, according to Egyptologists, bears no resemblance to what we have in the Book of Abraham. There's nothing about Abraham or of Abraham at all in the papyri. And so, again, this is another instance where we're basically saying that what Joseph did was there would be some text that might stand as a source of inspiration, but in no sense was it a translation in any sense of the word that we would assume today.
You know, I can't speak directly to, you know, that issue of the papyri, because you know, we have, as you mentioned, you know, the remnants of what was there in the fire, which means that you cannot say with absolute certainty that, you know, what we have in the Book of Abraham intended to translate that portion. Now, let's say that it did, and that what we have is a revelatory translation that doesn't bear any relationship to, you know, the words on the papyrus, and then we get the, you know, Book of Abraham out of it. We are left then with the Book of Abraham, just as we're left with the Book of Mormon, where we have to say, does this text actually reflect an understanding of the ancient world? And that's the part where, again, my understanding of the Book of Abraham is that it does. It's certainly my understanding and experience with the Book of Mormon that it certainly reflects the ancient world. So translation of something, whether it was, you know, those particular pieces of papyrus, you know, some other piece or conceptual translation, you know, revelatory translation like we have in the Book of Moses. However those things happen, you know, we have, you know, the mind and will of God being translated for us and to us.
Right. And so, again, in theory, the actual plates or the actual papyri weren't even necessary mechanically for the translation to be produced. they might have only just served as inspiration or, you know, something of that nature for the process that occurred, right?
That would be correct. And again, the question then becomes, you know, is the resulting translated text reflective of the culture that it says it should be? And that, again, becomes a different question.
Right. Just because the most extreme example is the one of the Kinderhook plates that sort of, some would say, is a factual expose of Joseph as fraud. Do you have a take on the Kinderhook plates?
I think the best answer to that is to refer everybody to Don Bradley's discussion of the Kinderhook plates from a fair conference. And I can't remember whether it was last year or the year before. I think it was last year. But he has some really, really good historical information on them that I think is, you know, absolutely the best discussion on them available. And I know that, I know that it's supposed to be available on the Fair Conference website. I actually don't know if it's up yet.
And the basic gist is what, if you remember, is it just that it never happened, or that Joseph never claimed to have translated, or
what? Yeah, basically that it. Actually, I can't remember what it is now. Whatever it is, it's not. It's one of those things where you read it and you go, "Oh yeah, that's what was going on." Of course.
Okay.
And certainly doesn't come across as an expose of Joseph as a translator. It the actual historical context reads very, very differently.
Okay. So, so as we kind of wrap up this section, well, is there anything else that you talk about in your book? What we're going to do in our last section, we're going to spend a little bit of time on the co-interview and the whole anachronism thing. My guess is that's going to go pretty quickly because you seem to have laid out an approach to what translation means that would allow for almost anything, to be written in the book and still not necessarily undermine the claim. But is there any other fundamental points that you make in the book that you want to make sure get conveyed in this part of the discussion? Cover the main things?
Yeah, I think we've covered pretty much the main things. One of the things that I try to do at the end of the book is to take that theory of translation and use it to see if we can explain, you know, historical information or events that otherwise might not have some explanation. So, one of the questions would be, you know, how do you know whether or not this is an accurate representation? And of course, you don't. It's an hypothesis. It's a theory. The only advantage that it has is that it does serve to explain certain features. And that's kind of how the book ends, is saying, you know, here's how you apply that theory to these other things. And the fact that if it works as an explanatory theory suggests that it's something other than, you know, just totally out of the blue.
Okay. Right. So you're saying that, I want to make sure I understood what you just said, but you're basically saying that there's more meat and credibility to the text if you look at it. It can't be that this was just total Joseph shooting from the hip. Is that what you're saying?
Well, not exactly, because that statement would have to do with the historicity, and I'm actually talking about the theory of the translation.
Okay.
So the idea is, if it is a functional translation and this is the way it happened, if this really is an explanation for the process that Joseph used, can we take that information and begin to explain other facets of history? So in other words, is the theory productive in being able to explain things rather than simply, you know, a wild theory that...
Oh, right.
Yeah. Is it useful?
Gotcha. So when you talk about how do we get the Isaiah passages,
right,
how do we get New Testament influence passages, How do we get revival language? You're basically testing the theory by explaining all these things that some people would list as problems, and you're saying, well, it depends on how you start with your assumptions. If you start with assumptions of a more functional type of translation, then all these things actually make perfect sense.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
That's correct.
Okay. Got it. Okay. So let me think. So is there a sense that this more literalistic view that many people have has been encouraged by church leaders over time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Again, looking at things historically, they certainly began with that very literalistic view and a very, I would say, simplistic view of the Book of Mormon and where it took place and how it explained things. And as I mentioned much earlier now, when I'm growing up in, the 1950s and the early 60s, I'm sitting in classes, all smug because I know how the Indians came to the New World and, this Bering Strait thing, was just scientific fiction. So, yeah, it's certainly been taught that way and understood that way. It has been, much more recently that there's been more research done into the Book of Mormon, and I think that we've had a more solid foundation for understanding it, than we had in the traditional way that everybody grew up with.
Okay, so, presidents of the church and members of the Quorum of the Twelve would probably have been encouraging this type of view, this more literalistic view of the translation. Is that fair to say?
Oh, certainly, and some certainly more than others. For as much as we like to say that the Quorum of Twelve is always unanimous in thought, certainly we know historically that hasn't been true, and there have been differences of opinion and differences of personalities and understandings. So there are going to be some who are going to be very adamant that the Book of Mormon is, boy, just exactly this way, the way tradition says, and others that would have been more open to, different kinds of geography or different interpretations of the text. I think things are in the process of changing over the last 40 years. I expect to see more change in the next 20 to 30, although, again, not as fast as some of us would like to see change, but it's going to happen.
So how much of this, we'll just, what do you like to call it, a functional theory of translation? What do you like to call it?
That'll do, yep.
How much of this can we find, like you said, 40, 50, 100 years ago, do we have any evidence of this, or is this your thinking? Is this just more modern thinking? Do we have a sense for when this emerges, and if there's a trend? Is this a 21st century thing?
Oh no, it's something that has sort of wandered in and out. As I mentioned, Brigham Young pretty much Brigham Young, I don't think, ever articulated a theory of the Book of Mormon or what it was like, but his statement that if someone other than Joseph Smith had translated, it would be substantially different, tells us that he understood that Joseph had a role,
right,
and that it couldn't have been, an absolute dictation word for word, or else it couldn't have changed or been substantially different. So we'll see that in Brigham Young. You see it certainly in B.H. Roberts. His understandings and he was quite vocal on the process of translation, and that was probably his conclusion, was that it would be more functional. So
how was that? Do we know how that was received?
It was printed in Sunday school manuals. It was sort of the explanation. That was kind of the official stuff.
And yet somehow he fell out of favor in the history books, in the official church narrative, it seems. Would he have had people who, let's just say the classic Joseph Fielding Smith, B.H. Roberts, rivalry. Would he have had members of the Quorum of the Twelve who were uncomfortable with this functional translation approach, and who would have fought with him about it or published alternative views or even denounced this functional translation of, you know, theory?
You know, without having any historical evidence to say so, it certainly wouldn't be surprising.
But no one's researched this that you're aware of. You know, we know about the evolution debates between B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith. Hey, are there any similar debates around Book of Mormon translation that you're aware of?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, so this has never been, this hasn't been an issue of debate.
Not really, and mostly because, again, the final statement from Joseph Smith is that it's by the gift and power of God, and, you know, it's really hard to prove any theory other than that because you just, you don't have much to go on. And what's tended to happen is that people have therefore said, this is the way I think it should be. And, you know, my attempt was to say, well, okay, you know, what does the evidence tell me? So, you know, one of the things that's somewhat different about the approach I'm taking is I'm actually looking at the evidence rather than making presumptions about what I think the evidence should be. Probably the most controversial thing from a orthodox viewpoint that I've got in the book is that I am not fond of Hebraisms as, you know, evidence of the Book of Mormon. I think they're evidence of the influence of the King James Version, but I don't see any conclusive evidence that there was any process of translation that authentically replicated Hebraisms apart from those that would naturally show up by imitating the King James Version.
But isn't that a big thrust of what the Maxwell Institute does these days?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And I have a good friend, David Bakavoy, who, you know, we are good friends and we respect each other. And on this one, we agree to disagree.
Okay. Got it. Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to this end joy your hearts will swell.
So
And should we die before our journey's through?